Extinction Diaries. More than 3,500.
Sorry, no time for Extinction Diaries. It's 9 p.m. You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. And, yes, Sweet Spot coming up in 1 hour, right after Cat Radio Cafe.
This is Cat Radio Cafe, a salon of the arts, exploring the creative bounty of New York. From WBAI Radio 99.5 on the FM dial. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. On tonight's show, we'll be joined by author Judy Gumbo to discuss her new memoir, Yippie Girl, Exploits in Protest and Defending, and I mean defeating. What did I say wrong there? Defeating the FBI. But first, this reminder to become a BAI buddy.
Oh, why, that is a sustaining member of WBAI for just $10 a month, or more if you like. It's easy to do because your bank or credit card will take care of it for you every month for as long as you want.
You can become a BAI buddy by simply calling 212-209-2950 or go online to give to the number 2, WBAI.org, and become a BAI buddy in the name of your favorite program.
Oh, probably Cat Radio Cafe.
That is a very good suggestion.
Okay.
So please help keep corporate misinformation from our door and independent media and free expression in the arts alive. We live in supremely lousy times. Let's not make them any worse. Support WBAI.
You know, as the great radical feminist Emma Goldman would say,
if I can't dance, I don't want your revolution. And now, on tonight's show, we'll be joined by author, activist Judy Gumbo to discuss her new memoir, Yippie Girl, Exploits in Protest and Defeating. Did you hear that? Defeating the FBI, a feminist insider's perspective on anti-war, environmental, and other forms of 1960s uproar, with extensive excerpts from years of illegal FBI surveillance after the author's years of successful legal action. As one of the few women participants in the original band of satirical protesters who created the Yippie movement, Gumbo was involved in organizing the protests at the Democratic Convention of 1968, the Chicago conspiracy trial, and trips to North Vietnam during the war. Judy Gumbo has a PhD in sociology and has spent the major part of her career as an award-winning fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. Hip, hip, hooray. She has traveled the globe agitating against the war and for the liberation of women, including herself. She currently lives in a co-housing community, is that still correct? In Berkeley, California. I am right on that one. Co-housing, you could go to another state, I guess, not be so. Well, welcome, Judy Gumbo. This was really a trip, your book. It's written in the same spirit of the girl you were. And let's start out talking about that girl that you were and the situation of a red diaper baby in Toronto, Canada. So different from a red diaper baby in Brooklyn. Not that different, though.
I don't think that's different at all. Except that Canadians tend to be more repressed. That's my sense, having known red diaper babies.
They don't sing the same songs or anything, or do they do?
Oh, we all definitely sing the same songs. We sing the same songs. We idolize Paul Robeson. We liked and now dislike Stalin. And we sure, in modern times, hate Vladimir Putin. That I can say.
Yes. Okay. All right. Here's to that. Yeah. You never know, do you? At what point?
You never know.
One guy goes in and one guy goes out. That's part of the art of dancing.
I just want to say, if people don't know what a red diaper baby is.
Yes, tell them, right.
It's a phrase to describe children of Communist Party parents. Because of they were the Reds in those days, not the Republicans. They were the Reds.
Right. It's an amusing way to describe being blacklisted or, you know, being harassed or stultified in your political beliefs. But
exactly.
It more than worked, put it that way. All of those, you know, the Red Scare, it was called here.
That's right.
Did you have a Red Scare there, or was it just an always ongoing thing?
Well, there were a couple of times when my father, who was, by the way, the first person to import what we called Soviet, but were actually Russian films to the entire North American continent. There were times when he left Toronto, leaving my mother and my sister and myself behind, and basically went to a smaller town, quote unquote, underground, but continued to show the films. But I grew up with not Solzhenitsyn. Who am I thinking of? I grew up with all the famous Russian filmmakers because my father would bring them and show them in my grandmother's living room. We lived downstairs from my grandmother. So
wow, that was a great education right there, wasn't
yes.
it? Were they bookish as well? Were they intellectuals?
My parents, yeah.
And they go ahead.
No, I was going to say that there were certain books I was not allowed to read.
Oh, which ones? Oh, yes, I remember that. Tell the listeners what you couldn't read.
There was a book by this guy called Seduction of the Innocent, and it was basically a book of illustrations that you normally would find in comics, but it really talked about how Batman and Robin were gay. I can find and read a little bit from it if you want, but it was very misogynist, sexist, racist, the whole thing. And for whatever reasons, I was attracted to the comics because, I wasn't allowed. It was not intellectual to read comics. So I didn't have any comics in the house. So I would sneak at night and go and get Seduction of the Innocent and look at the comics, until my mother caught me and
Did the comics include in that book really defaming all our great comic book art history? What did they include? Mad Magazine or Mad Comics, even better?
You know, I would have to go back to the source. I don't remember Mad Comics, but I do remember the Batman Robin and Wonder Woman was a lesbian. It was that type of misogyny.
Right. And he wasn't kidding around like Mad Magazine, which could
do the same thing. No.
And was, in a way, a precursor of Yippie, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. In the sense that we, Yippies, what we liked most was satire, was the ability to satirize the establishment, the evil people, and show them, bring them up to ridicule. So by ridicule, we could get people to see that there was more to life than obeying and conforming.
Right. And that's a rather fine line to walk. It's hard to remain funny and as well as be angry and be political and be a political, literal protester. To be on the streets fighting is different from, you know, being inside with a cupcake, reading, you know, comics and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So let's just dive into it. Let's talk about how you breezed out of Canada and moved to, I mean, I don't think your moves were all, they were those of an American, oddly enough. That's what American kids did. They went right to Berkeley, California to check it out. And back to New York City and in and out of Chicago. And those were the routes that were taken to meet sort of other people who were in flux in their politics. They were beginning to form the new revolutionary youth movement, whatever that may be and however it ended. We don't know yet, I guess. But maybe you could talk about how really courageous it was, if you see it that way, for you to just leave Canada with, I mean, you think your father tucked some money into your Yippie bag, your beatnik bag, and then you just shoveled off to San Francisco. Would you talk some about it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I didn't actually look at it as courageous at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I didn't was because I had come home. I had been married at age 24 and come home a couple of years after the wedding, which was a very bougie commie wedding.
Mm-hmm.
find the husband, the first husband, in bed with another woman in our bed.
Wow.
So I wasn't going to, right. That wasn't sort of, oh, I'm going to go on a big adventure. That was F you, you.
You got to get out of there, right.
I've got to get out of there. And mm-hmm. I lived with my parents for a few months, and I toured Europe with a couple of people I knew from college. But really, I needed to get out of there. And at the time, I was studying for my PhD in sociology. So as it happened, luckily for me, there was a sociology association convention in San Francisco.
Right.
And you can imagine what it was like for this Canadian used to repression and cold coming to San Francisco, where it was warm. There were paisley jackets in the windows. There were people on the street selling everything you could possibly want. And I was just enthralled with San Francisco and met someone at the convention who said, well, Judy, if you decide to move, you can come and live with me. So I decided to move. I came to live with him, but he turned out to be a pretty straight-laced Marxist type, which was not
right.
what
you were after. You already had that experience, right?
Exactly. Didn't need that. He was a different faction. My parents hated the faction that he was in, but they never met him, so that was okay. But he moved me after about 3 weeks. He moved me to this amazing house in the Berkeley Hills at 1049 Keith Street. And it had plaster cherubs on the fireplaces. And it had a room with columns where people were, the Floating Lotus Magic Opera Company had staged an opera in that house 2 weeks before I moved in.
Wow.
So it was, and the bathroom had tiles around, a sunken bathtub and tiles around the bathtub and windows. Now, the windows weren't so good because you get cold air coming in from the Berkeley Hills, but it was still the most imaginative house I'd ever been in.
Did you ever trace or find out the provenance of that house? Does it still exist in Berkeley?
It definitely still exists. With the current owner, I went and visited with my current husband, number four. We went and visited they're great people and they recognize the provenance of the house and they have, enough has been done to it so that it's not exactly the same my house to live in, but I used to live in, but the cherubs on the fireplaces are still there.
Mm-hmm.
Sunken bathtub is still there. I'm sorry, what?
Do they now have heat and so forth? Can you close the window?
Yeah, that was important. And the other thing that was really important, they remodeled the kitchen. It had like a 1930s stove in it when I lived there. But it maintained its essential hippie character. And,
Excellent. Only it's probably about $70 million now, right?
Exactly.
Hippie as you can get in Berkeley.
That's right.
Housing,
that's right.
So now, once there, it's of course a very welcoming campus. It's not hard to meet people, and it does seem that people, because of the warmth of the place, they're all out there on the street. You can become a leftist activist very easily. But you seem to pick, the most excellent partners, friends, and partners, like the creme de la creme of the Berkeley Political Society. Talk about your meeting with Stu Oppert and his best friend, Eldridge Cleaver.
All right. Well, I met Stu at a meeting of the Oakland Seven, who were seven guys who had protested the Vietnam War. And I guess I've always had a penchant for blondes, because I walked into the Oakland 7 meeting and there were not one but two blondes, okay? There was Stu, who had beautiful curly blonde hair and a nice big sort of chest. And then there was Steve, who had straight hair, and he was also very handsome. Now, so I walked up to them, and I'm not a very shy person, you may gather. So I walk up to the two of them, and I walk up to Stu, and I say, hi, my name is Judy. I just came here from Canada. And Stu reached out his hand and touched me on the nose with his little finger. Huh. And that was the electricity. And we were also good friends with Steve, who decided not long afterwards that he was gay. And so I really ended up making the right choice and still being able to be friends with Steve. And Stu, how I speaking of friendship, Stu had two best friends. Okay.
Oh, yes.
One of them was Eldridge Cleaver, the Minister of Information for the Black Panther mm-hmm. Party. And the other was Jerry Rubin, one of the Yippie founders. So, I guess again, I lucked out.
What was Jerry Rubin doing in Berkeley? Had he come from Berkeley, or I forget his origin story. I just remember him from basically here, you know, New York City. Where was he from?
He was actually from the Midwest.
Yeah, I thought so. That's why I was so over the top. Tried too hard.
Yeah. That's really funny. Well, when I first met Stu, Jerry had already moved from Berkeley, where he had been living, and had run for mayor of Berkeley. But he hadn't won. But he had moved from Berkeley to New York to work on the levitation of the Pentagon, uh-huh. which he and Abby were among the organizers of. And Stu had not. I don't remember the reasons. I know I have it in Yippie Girl. I can't recall at the moment, having something to do with his wife, who he was separated from. Anyway, so I met Stu, and actually the first of Stu's friends that he introduced me to were Eldridge and Kathleen Cleaver.
Ah.
And they were what you call the role models mm-hmm. Of the Black liberation struggle, who especially the thing about the Panthers that was different from all the other Black organizations at that time was the Panthers welcomed white support.
Right.
So after I go into this in Yippie Girl, but after spending time with and becoming friends with Eldridge and Kathleen, Jerry called the house and said, Stu, in his way, Stu, you got to come to New York. We're organizing a demonstration. You got to come. And Stu said, oh, he was much more, tranquil than Jerry. And so he said, okay. And then he turned to me and he said, Judy, will you come with me to New York? I think we should live together when you get to New York. And I said, sure, why not?
Tell me one thing before we leave Berkeley and the Black Panthers. What was it about Eldridge Cleaver, or rather really about Stu Alpert, that Eldridge Cleaver was able to trust him so deeply?
Well,
you know, this was an aspect of his personality, I think, that attracted you too. But if you could define it, your characterizations of all these people are very clearly defined in this book. But for the listening audience, what you say, what do you call this connection?
Well, yeah, first of all, Eldridge had been basically released from, I think by then he was in San Quentin, through the efforts of the attorney Beverly Axelrod.
Mm-hmm.
And Stu was good friends with Beverly. So Beverly introduced, when Eldridge got out, introduced Eldridge and Stu. This is actually even before we met, before Stu and I met, introduced them. And certainly because Eldridge trusted Beverly, the connection really clicked. And also Eldridge was in his own way a Yippie. But a Black Panther first and foremost, but he had a great sense of humor mm-hmm. and great Yippie tendencies. And mm-hmm. again, in Yippie Girl, I talk about some of the, mm-hmm. the things that we did. And so did Kathleen, by the way.
Yes. Well,
also,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's a marvelous person.
She is.
And so I think it was both our absolute support for the Black liberation struggle. The Panthers, and specifically Eldridge, who was kind of in the lead of this, of saying we want white support as long as it's recognized that Black people are in the lead, that we are in the lead.
Right.
And that was something that it's taken organizations these days a lot to find out. You can't be a supporter of Black people's struggle without allowing them, giving them, not interfering with their ability to take the lead. That was like lesson one for me, in terms of how to be a political person.
I think that is a point. Hard to know when it's going off the rails, but I mean, it is when you're a white person. You just don't know what you've done, what you've missed. You know, because you have missed it.
You have missed
being somebody is what? Okay, let's wait. There we are. Outer space calling. Okay. So now that I understand that relationship, let's move on back to your move to New York City, which isn't very far from where I am, actually. It's like I could fly there. It would be a very short flight to where you lived. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, well, Stu had arrived. I arrived. I went to Canada. I divorced the cheating first husband, and I landed in New York City and went to a place called Liberty House. And at Liberty House, there Stu was waiting. And this was where it was a cellar. He had found a cellar in which to live. For both of us. And it was, you know, I was coming from a bougie commie family, but this cellar.
You had nice rugs and sofas and stuff, right? In the bougie.
Well, Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know, three stories and the whole bit. But the thing about the cellar was that Stu made me feel wanted and adored. Because he had put this cellar together, and you know, it had goods that were going to go upstairs to Liberty House. It had a kettle and a crock pot, and that was it. That was cooking. So it was a whole different way. Really counterculture. And Abby would come and visit, and Jerry would come and visit, and Paul would come and visit, and Bill Kunstler wanted to kick us out, but then came and decided he wouldn't do that. So it was a little mini central of yippies in New York, pre Chicago 68.
Well, a couple of them actually lived in very close, few feet away, really. The Kunstler lived on Gay Street, and Paul Krasner at first. I remember him from Cornelius Street. He lived at Cornelius Street. Do you think that was about the era we're talking about? Okay.
And Phil Oakes was around there, too.
I don't know what it is. Bleecker Street is a little oddity at the moment because during the pandemic, a lot of the long-lasting storefronts disappeared and some of them hung in. But it's definitely going to be a work in progress, and I won't be surprised if Tiffany shows up there. And now let's even though we have so much to say, we want to take a little musical break to send you back to that period, because the singer here is another character that was an adjunct to the hippies. He was certainly part of the inner circle of entertainment during the anti-war years. And this is his great song. It's Phil Oakes, and his great song is I'm Not Marching Anymore. And let's hear that and get a flavor of what the essence of the protest was. Yeah.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close a missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
Ooh, gives me the shivers, really, to hear that. This is Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman here with Judy Gumbo. The great Judy Gumbo, who is one of, who knew Phil Oakes, the singer of that song, that anthem, I'm Not Marching Anymore. And we're here talking about her terrific new book, Yippie Girl, Exploits in Protest and Defeating the FBI. And, which is so, I mean, the characters in this book and the moments of action are so finely and funnily drawn. It's really remarkable. It's really one of the terrific moment by moment histories of the leftist protests, at least the ones that Judy Gumbo attended, of the 60s. And in, if that were all it was, it would be a terrific read, you know, just to remember all the circumstances then. And by the way, WBAI, which you can call in at any time to support at 212-209-2950 or give to the number 2 WBAI.org, was a major outpost for all of these, for almost all of these people on the Bob Fast show. You could tune in just about every night except when they were in Chicago. Then you'd tune into them on the phone at night, hearing what had gone down and what was horrible and what was great about it all. So let's talk about, let's go first to Liberty House, which was a place that sold, It was hats and bags and stuff like that that were made by sharecroppers in the South to raise money for various liberation movements there and sold them here. Like, what, your beautiful hat was $4?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was an amazing, it was actually a very important funding source for the struggle, the Southern civil rights struggle. Yeah, so, and the person who, Abby was actually the manager of Liberty House on Bleecker Street, but he went left to join the Yippies. And the person who managed it was Ellen Maslow, who was the daughter of the famed psychologist Abraham Maslow. I think one of the things that people don't get about the 60s, or at least the countercultural end, is that there were a lot of us, the young folks, who were sort of out in the streets and protesting, but the generation before us, was a very prominent generation of intellectuals and activists. They were just, you know, the parents were really amazing too. So it's something to think about.
You mean the intergenerational part of it? That lots of red diaper babies became counterculturalists with the addition of worse clothes and a much better sense of humor than their parents. I think that was all. That's what, and they were not as, they were not sober either in the same way.
No.
At least.
Right.
Yeah. No, it was
a difference between alcohol and marijuana.
Well, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Those were the big things, right. And they were big. It's hard to believe it now when there's a place called Weed World on right on where the liquor store used to be, really.
Oh, really?
On 6th Avenue, yeah. It's like, you know, 50 years of being a criminal or whatever, and then, woo. Yeah, it is funny, but it's not when you think about how many people were busted for this stuff. Anyway.
Not very much. I went served time.
And served time, right. So back to being innocent of all that was to come, really. And you were. Why? I'm curious. Again, I think of what was it, courage or just innocence, naivete about how all this, or not being a red diaper baby enough, not getting, having your parents be fired and have no way to live, or have the FBI trail you in your very young years. How come you weren't scared they'd be back?
The FBI back?
Yeah.
I didn't think at that time I was doing anything especially subversive.
You weren't.
And I wasn't. So, I figured that my parents, they'd had their experiences with it. I'd heard many stories of communists who had been surveilled. It just never occurred to me that they would come and surveil me. But I'll tell you, it was a good lesson for me. And there were certain points where it was kind of tempting. Stu, for example, was tempted to talk to the FBI because he figured he could outsmart them.
Yeah.
And he would try to do that. He did that once at the Keith Street house, and I just railed at him for that. And there was one thing that really was imprinted on me, which is never talk to the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Never talk to
that
the FBI.
William Kunstler in your place.
Well, when I found the tracking device, which we can talk about, when I found the tracking device on the car, the first thing that came to mind was, when you're in trouble with the law, find your lawyer.
Right.
And luckily, even now, there's enough movement lawyers around that it's possible to abide by that. But that was an amazing experience in and of itself, finding a tracking device on my car.
What did you think it was?
Well, you know, can I read you something?
Sure, that'd be great.
All right, let me do that because this is the quintessential finding of the tracking device. So we by then my Volkswagen had died, so we'd purchased an old Volvo. So I'll read from Yippie Girl. I parked our Volvo close by Margie and Bill Kunstler's home in Greenwich Village. I could not put my finger on it exactly, but the air around me seems charged with ions of suspicion. I spotted, or so I thought, a man in a trench coat and fedora lurking in the shadows of a nearby stairwell. I ignored him. This is New York, I told myself. Everybody lurks in New York. Then I chose... In an act of spontaneous yippie theater for which I was forever grateful, I chose to walk around my car's perimeter looking for I knew not what, which is exactly when I saw it. A smear in the middle of my rear bumper as if some employee in a car wash had wiped away the dirt I'd accumulated on my trip downstate. In the center of the smear, I glimpsed a 6-inch-long black wire hanging down, a wire which I knew did not belong. I squatted in the gutter, avoiding its stream of gray ice water as best I could, and contemplated the wire. The curiosity I've had my entire life trumped any foreboding. I called Stu over. What do you think this is? I asked him. I looked at the wire, stroked his beard, shook his head, but made no comment. He knew nothing about cars. Born and raised in Brooklyn, Stu had never learned to drive. I told myself the wire came from a bomb placed underneath my car by the FBI or some God knows who right winger. To go out in a flaming blaze of glory would be a quintessential yippie act. Such a death might at least attract the media. And of course, the yippies were always interested in finding the media. You wait on the sidewalk. I turned to Stu, commanding in my best General Gumbo voice. I'm going to turn the engine on and see if it starts. Stu refused. He sat down heavily in his usual place in the passenger seat. Stu told me later he did not want to see a headline that read, "Sexist Survives."
That's great. That's great.
And then the story goes on from there.
The beginning of your trials, your your difficulties with the FBI. Because magically, you escaped, I mean, Stu escaped being one of the Chicago 8 or 7, as they became.
Right.
And yes, I'd like to, because I think that in some way is, I mean, it defines the ups and downs of Yippie satire, really. You got the pig that you were going to run, right. Pig Assist, the pig that the Yippies ran for president. But there seems to be more to that story, more personality than pure politics to that story. And that is the temperaments that very vividly described here, very briefly but vividly described the different personalities of both Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. And I mean, I think any reader is going to say, oh, he's my favorite. I hate this guy. I like this guy. I'm on his side. So talk a little bit about them and how the amazingly sane, always, almost always sane, as you convey him, Stu Alpert, could remain so attached to such lovers of the limelight as Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. How did you, talk about that, because it seemed to me those observations are those of a deep feminist. No, not another, another guy wouldn't have picked up so easily on this.
Well, that I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's
yeah.
true. Well, Stu, as I say, he came into the Yippies through Jerry, but he was also very good friends with Abby and with Anita.
Mm-hmm.
And with Jerry, there was Nancy Kershaw too. So it wasn't like they were just guys on their own.
Right.
The women moderated the most extreme of the, both their tendencies. But I think that the main issue, is that the Yippies wanted theatrical protest, and at the trial, it was not such an easy thing to do.
Right.
Because there were just so many people, and so many of the defendants came from more the quote unquote straighter side,
right.
like Tom
right.
Hayden and what's his name?
Rennie Davis.
And Rennie, right.
And who's Dave Dellinger was a very serious guy.
But Rennie, Dave, and Stu were sort of the three people who were able to bring both sides, the Hayden and John Freund side together, as opposed to the Abby Jerry side.
Right.
And ultimately, and they had many conversations as to what type of defense they would put on. And the answer was they ended up with a combined defense. They had a lot of people who were able to testify just specifically about the attack of the cops and how that happened. And then there were people like Judy Collins and Paul Krasner, who, by the way, took LSD and melted down on the stand.
Right.
And Abby didn't forgive him for about a year for doing that.
How
because
could
their
he
lives
not? Were- that does not seem fair. I mean, really, is that a proper Yippie response?
Well, their lives were at stake.
Yeah, I guess.
Their lives were at stake.
I'm only kidding, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, but they faced 5 years each for conspiracy.
It was the worst. So, it was a horror scene, really.
Exactly. Now, the other thing is that, what was I going to say? That I just lost the train of thought. But they.
Oh, about how he was negotiating. How Stu managed to negotiate between the straighter guys and the.
Right. Yeah. And Jerry and Jerry did not testify. I know. Let's throw in the Sorkin film. And the reason we call it the Trial of the Chicago 8, and Sorkin called it the Trial of the Chicago 7.
Right.
And the reason for that is that Bobby Seale was protesting not being allowed to act as his own attorney since his attorney, Charlie Gary, had gotten ill and couldn't make it. And so Bobby protested. He was chained. He was gagged. And eventually his case was severed from the other 7. So the Chicago 8 became the Chicago 7.
I wonder if the fact that Sorkin left the Bobby, I guess it would have been the end of the drama, really. It was the actual drama, Bobby Seale being gagged. And, you know, it was the high.
He had that in the movie. I don't know if you saw the movie, but he had that.
Was Bobby Seale in that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he was. And then it's just my crazy, just fading memory.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, really.
But here's the thing. You probably don't remember that Bobby, that Sorkin had Fred Hampton essentially being Bobby's legal assistant.
Right.
But that actually was not true. Right. Bobby's legal assistant was a black woman, a good friend of mine named Mickey Lehner.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her about this. I said, Mickey, how did you feel about Sorkin taking your job and giving it to Fred Hampton? She said, I was honored. I was honored that Sorkin thought that what I did was important enough to have my hero, Fred Hampton, do this. So that was to me, okay, Sorkin, I may not be happy with your movie, but to have Mickey say that just made a huge difference to my perception of the movie.
Awesome.
But after Bobby's case was severed, then the Chicago 8 did become the Chicago 7, and I acted for about 3 weeks as the trial sort of manager. Couldn't do it at all. Everybody was so anarchistic, they were totally unmanageable. But what I did end up doing was sending out transcripts of the daily trial, which were very dramatic, to media outlets, not only in the United States, but around the world. And I learned from that she who can communicate history can rule worlds. Wow. Because I was able to define, getting those trial transcripts out, they were printed in newspapers everywhere, getting those trial transcripts out was a very yippee and important act. So it's like you never know how things are going to turn out, right? You never know.
Did you communicate in that role with Bob at WBAI, Bob Fass? Were you on the radio? Yeah. Uh-huh.
I don't know if – I don't recall.
We did get reports.
We came down to the station a lot. I do remember that.
Yeah. Well, that was –
Bob, he preferred to interview Abby and Jerry.
Well, they were his – yeah. Because he could.
Yeah, right. They were his friends. They were his pals.
They were his pals. And they used to hang out with him in his recording studio all the time.
Exactly.
I mean, they were there sometimes every night. And, carousing in their way and mocking the politics of the day. Which turned out once this trial, and once the whole event in 1968 at Grant Park occurred, Lincoln Park, was it? Which was it?
Both
parks. Both parks
Grant
in Chicago.
Park was very blessed few days.
Right. It were, so tremendously distressing to this movement. I mean, it really made you realize what a big enemy you were up against. It wasn't just, it wasn't nothing. It wasn't a walk in the park, put it that way.
Yeah, so to speak. it's interesting. That reminds me of May Day, which was in 1971. Mm. And Larry Roberts has a really terrific book about that. But what I didn't know was that President Nixon was freaking out because we were in the streets, in Washington, D.C. streets, blocking traffic to protest the war. He fantasized that we were going to climb over the fence to the White House and come into the White House. So there was a lot of extreme reaction. And Hoover, certainly, J. Edgar Hoover, who was dead by the time of May Day, but J. Edgar Hoover certainly was concerned about the actual power that the protest movement had, which is a lesson to me, even about present time, that protest can have power. I personally think that people who are horrified at what happened in Texas the other day should go to this. There's an NRA convention in Houston coming up in a few days. Go stand outside and hold signs and protest the gun violence in this country through action.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are kind of withdrawing from it. Entertainers. I heard Don McLean was... Who got by? Which is a few entertainers are leaving a lot of people don't want to be involved anymore with the NRA as a result of this. I think it's a game changer. I hope. Well, we always do.
That's how the anti-war movement started, too.
Yeah.
People, and the women's movement. People at first did not want to be involved because it was scary, because it was difficult, because they had their lives. But the more a movement develops and becomes charismatic and people are part of it, the more influence it actually has.
Mm. Well, we now are down to about 10 minutes more, so I'll let you, because we have barely covered your life and protest career and your writing and your and the good works you've done for feminism and for anti-warism. You went to North Vietnam. So let's choose a couple of those and see. I think we have to discard the other song we would have played, which is, let's just say it, it's Volunteers by the Jefferson Airplane, another, you know, Back to the Future kind of listening experience. But choose the kind of two things you want us to know about, to talk about now in the closing 10 minutes or so of this program. Although I feel we have to get you back. You have to get back to Bleecker Street.
Well, I'm
Judy Gumbo.
I'm happy to do that. You know, I mean, we touched on one, and one is the importance of protest and the power of protest and the fact that you can't allow yourself to be intimidated by propaganda. It turns out that I had not one but two tracking devices on my car. The first one I had absolutely no idea was there, but the second one I used my feminist intuition to find it and then to sue the FBI.
Yeah.
So which the main outcome of my lawsuit was that they stopped surveilling me.
That's amazing.
They
had been surveilling you from very early on. Isn't that true? Under J. Edgar Hoover's leadership of the FBI. So you were a target for years before you even found these monitoring devices, correct?
Right.
You had a big
But at first I was a target just like many, many people in the social protest movement.
Mm-hmm.
It was at a certain point that I became what, you know, there's TV shows called Prime Suspect. I became a prime suspect. And at that point, the surveillance totally, totally intensified. And here's a quote from the FBI that I love. Stu Albert and Judy Gumbo are difficult to surveil because of the extreme paranoia that pervades their thinking about being surveilled. I mean, really.
You changed the paranoia word. I got that one right. They may call it paranoia. You called it, what's up here? What's with this transmitter in my car? But you were being surveilled in Chicago at the time of the protest there, of the Daley riot, the Richard Daley riots. You were aware of it then? You had an intuition then?
No, none.
But there was a guy, guy whose house you were staying at. He was an FBI informant. Amazing, really.
Well, actually, no. He was a former informant.
Oh, yeah.
Abby was telling us, "Don't stay there." But we, you know, it was hard to find places to stay.
Right.
But the guy who you're talking about was an actual real policeman named Robert Pearson, and he dressed as a biker and he followed Jerry around and he followed us around, then lo and behold, there he is speaking for the prosecution at the conspiracy trial.
Wow. So you were tuned to what you were tuned into the type of spying, the surveillance you might be under at most times, at all times.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you know, let's all take out our cell phones and understand that when we take our cell phones around with us, we're surveilling ourselves.
Right. Right. And if anyone else is interested, them too.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, times have really changed. I mean, the tracking device that I found was like 6 inches long and 3 inches wide. It was quite substantial. It was not a little tiny bug or a cell phone.
Yeah. So they hadn't mastered that craft yet of getting it down, getting the electronics real small and tiny. So check your apartments, everybody. It could be really small.
I think in closing, times have really changed. That's one reason that the book is fun to read, because it takes us back to a more innocent and a more fun time where people could do things and actually still have an effect. I think that now, we, the older generation, it's a lot harder to do the kind. We can't be running in the streets the way we used to.
Right.
But it's still so important for everyone who feels that there's an oppressive system that we need to protest. It's so important to do that. You take Zelensky, right? He was a comic. He is a yippie.
Right.
He is leading his country against an authoritarian a-hole and who is really responsible for the deaths of thousands and thousands of people. So we need to not give up. That it would be, if I have any message to people who are listening, it's to stay involved and in the best way that you can for yourself. I mean, you have to.
Well, you invented so many ways, and a lot of those ways are not so easy anymore. And you're right about that, because the generation that recalls this period, I remember old women in walkers, but I don't see them out now. It's harder.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why. Maybe they're actually older, younger women. Those old women were really young women on walkers. I'm not sure, but it separates the generations, which should not happen.
Right.
Those have to be connected. Yeah.
They have to be connected. Speaking as an elder, we also, if we want to survive, we also have to take care of ourselves in a way that we never knew how. I have a phrase, which is getting old did not prepare me to be yippie. Right.
Right.
Getting old did not prepare me to be a yippie. It didn't. And
continue to be.
And so it's a new set of skills that you have to learn.
I guess so.
But we must. We all must.
We all must.
And we must do what we can.
I think reading your book is a very effective way to develop your imagination for this kind of thing, because it was so, I don't know, people took steps. They did. They had ideas and they acted on them. I don't know whether people are short of ideas now or we haven't seen them. We don't know yet. I like to think.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's the Yippie Girl is the one thing that I know I can do these days.
That's right.
And have an influence. I may not be able to run in the streets the way I used to, but I can write a book that people will read and enjoy, may have an influence on how they, which I hope will have an influence on how they choose to live their lives.
Yeah. Well, very bravely and originally, I must say, you are an inspiration. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Can you dig it?
I really do.
What?
Can you dig it? Exactly. Can you dig it?
Who named you, by the way? Gumbo. Just quickly. We only have, seconds left.
Oh,
seconds.
That was Eldridge Cleaver.
That was
Eldridge Cleaver.
Eldridge Cleaver.
Yeah. He used to call me Mrs. Stew. I objected. He said, all right. He thought about it. And then he said, all right, then I'll call you Gumbo. And that allowed me to develop an identity. Even though it had a relationship to Stew, it allowed me to develop an identity of my own. And that was very important.
Very important. So thank you, Eldridge Cleaver, for that. And thank you, Judy Gumbo, for this book. And I figure we'll see you around here.
I hope to come to New York soon.
Right. And you're this co thing in Berkeley. Well, that's not so far either, is it? It's been a pleasure having you to talk to, and I wish I'd known you back in those days on Bleecker Street. I must have been across the street.
Me too. I wish that would have been great.
Yes. So I'll remind everybody, as I will once more, that Yippie Girl is published by Three Rooms Press, published by Two, which has its offices on Bleecker Street, luckily enough. The wonderful Cat Georges and Peter Karlofte. It's a great, I think they are going to continue the hippie beatnik movement into eternity with their diligent work about recording all the people who have memories of those days. Very important. So thank you so much. Read this book. Oops. You've been listening to Cat Radio Cafe, heard Tuesdays at 9 p.m. on WBAI. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozier.
The display playwright.
Yeah.
You can reach us at catradiocafe at gmail, and you can pledge to WBAI on our behalf at give2wbai.org.
Or wait a minute, how about that telephone?
What
you can use 212-209-2950 and contribute as a BAI buddy, a sustaining member of WBAI for as little as $10 a month.
That's 212-209-2950.
Or wait a minute. Go to give2wbai.org. I cannot make up my mind. You go here, the phone, you go to the internet,
either
whatever you're doing, back and forth. Wow.
With special thanks to Bob Auld on tonight's show, we were joined by author activist Judy Gumbo, who discussed her book. It's a new memoir called Yippie Girl, Exploits and Protest and Defeating the FBI. Yippie Girl, I just said it, is published by Three Rooms Press. Don't forget it. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, Judy Gumbo.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Through the windows of cars. Ooh. Ooh.
If you're filing taxes, you may be eligible for some pretty unique deductions. For instance, there are write-offs for clarinet lessons. Or, if you hired your cat for pest control, apparently there's a tax break for that too. But, if you don't think you'd qualify for pet-related deductions, you could just donate a vehicle to WBAI. It's easy, free, and tax-deductible. Here's how it works. Call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or complete the online form at wbai.org/donateyourcar. From there, our vehicle donation support team will take care of everything, including the pickup, sale, and provide you with a donation receipt. If your vehicle sells for more than $500, you'll also receive a 1098C tax form. So, instead of writing off your cat patrol, you can support programs like the Cat Radio Cafe by donating a car, truck, RV, or boat. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit wbai.org/donateyourcar to get started.
Hi there, this is Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary, and you are listening to one of the great icons of radio in my life, WBAI, 99.5 FM. This is listener-sponsored radio. This is the radio that has the dialogue, the inspiration, the humanity, the hope, the heart that we need. With this kind of radio, with listener-sponsored radio, we get something other than being sold objects. So support this radio station, know that it's important, and know that Puff the Magic Dragon will be there for you to support it with you, as well as Puff's daddy, Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Thank you, make a contribution, stay with us, and listen to the best there is right here.
Greetings, this is Dr. James McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties, end your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Joy of resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance.
March is Women's History Month, dedicated to putting women back into histories written by men and about men. Every Thursday in March at 11 a.m., Joy of Resistance will bring you special women's history programming. We will cover the reproductive justice movement that brought a woman of color spin to reproductive rights, black women leaders of the civil rights movement, the FBI assault on the women's movement, the political history of the bra, and how book banning by the right wing is erasing women's history today. And that's only some of it. That's 11 a.m. on Thursdays in March. Women's history as you've never known it.
Joy of resistance. Sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
Hi, this is Eric Anderson.
This is Rosie Perez.
You're tuned to WBAI.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is LL Cool J.
This is Dave Marsh.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
Hi, this is Julie Cruz from New York City, and you're listening to
WBAI FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener-supported.
I don't listen to the radio.
I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI in New York.